Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with Utah Foundation President Sean Tigan about social capital, which they define as the bonds between people and among networks, which they can use to benefit themselves and the group as a whole. The Utah Foundation released a report on social capital in 2021. They're preparing to release an update. We're going to talk about some of the factors: social trust, social cohesion, civic engagement, community life, family health, and other factors which go into social capital. And we bring in Sean Tigan. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Tom.
So I guess a good starting point, how do you define social capital?
Yeah, so social capital it's the sociological term that much like when people talk about human capital or economic capital, it's a way of talking about a concept that maybe is hard to put too much of a pin in terms of the definition, but we talk about it, like you said, it's those bonds between people and among networks, which they can use to benefit themselves and groups as a whole. So that's our definition. We feel like it encompasses the concept pretty well. So it looks both at the bonds with individuals, it's those, and then it, as well as those bonds within networks. And what is the use of those? I mean, there are some types of social capital that are perhaps bad. So we're looking at the ones that are those that benefit those individuals and those groups.
So if you talk to an economist, they're measuring physical capital, right? This is kind of a similar thing, just transferring it over to social bonds.
Yeah, and I'd mention it's hard to define in some ways. I believe that, you know, the economists, economics, it's a bit of a social, it's a bit of like a soft science. And so some of those measures are a little bit tricky, even in economics, and that much to the chagrin maybe of some economists that wouldn't want to hear that. But I think that those are somewhat a little bit tricky. This is another way of looking at society through the lens of people on the ground that have these connections and have these networks that might be connections in extended families. They might be connections in churches. They might be connections when you're at the hockey game, watching those games and kind of getting excited about it together. But it's also connections that benefit us in terms of like, hey, I'm looking for a job. Does anybody know anything out there? And I might have, I might know of a connection with somebody that's looking for an employee and kind of help make those links that really benefit people in their household economics and beyond.
So this will get us into areas for people to make connections. Political polarization, right? Kind of relates. Levels of civic engagement, fragmentation, that all related areas.
Yeah, and so like political polarization. So you can think about this as like the negative ramifications of political polarization. It's that maybe we ignore rational thought that might be coming from a different group or whatever the case may be. But there and it makes us sort people and judge people right off the bat by saying, oh, you wear that red hat, or you wear whatever that blue, what's the blue equivalent, blue tie or something. But there are some positive benefits of that polarization as well. And it's that we're sorting ourselves into groups of people that maybe we can bond with over a certain thing. We can bond with over a certain kind of political, maybe a tax cut or some kind of social benefit that we see for the community.
So some of this is kind of based on Robert Putnam's work, right? I think.
Yeah. So this is quite a bit of this is based on Robert Putnam's work. He started talking about social capital decades ago, and we actually had him come out the first time we did this kind of social capital project back about 4 or 5 years ago. We had him come out and talk to a group at our annual luncheon to help kind of do a soft launch of our social capital project. But he started looking at this because he saw the import of it, particularly when, his famous book, Bowling Alone, when we used to have these groups, we get on a bowling league and we get out there and be out, you know, numerous nights a week with people that we may have differences in or differences with across either politics or socioeconomic status, but we have maybe this love for this bowling game. And so we get together and maybe benefit ourselves by having, you know, a good time, but benefit ourselves by, like I brought up this idea of perhaps getting a job through some of your networks, or getting a hand fixing a car through one of your networks, or whatever the case may be. And the reason why he started talking about this is he saw bowling alleys kind of with fewer and fewer people and seeing fewer and fewer bowling leagues. And so you don't really have those benefits. And even if you see a lot of people in a bowling alley, they may not be in a bowling league. It's like we're bowling with the people that we came here with, and we don't want to meet anybody else. We're here with ourselves and maybe that's our family or close friends. And there's some benefits there too. Mm-hmm. But he was concerned about that breakdown of that kind of larger network across networks across society. And we are at the Utah Foundation concerned about that as well, which is why we started this project about 5 years ago.
So what counts as social? I'm thinking of social media, you know, you can feel like you're reaching out to people, but it's maybe not as powerful, and maybe it can have negative effects too.
Yeah. So, and there probably are some, you know, they're like the topics we brought up already, there are probably some positive and negative ramifications to social media. So some of the positive things are that we might have connections, regardless of how like kind of small those connections are or how limited they are in terms of conversation and whatnot, but we might have connections that we wouldn't have had as many of 30 years ago or 20 years ago when we didn't have kind of this social media network. So we may keep in touch with people more regularly and more often than we would if they moved away or if they lived in another community and we were pretty busy. But like you said, what are the negative ramifications? Maybe we replace that social media connection that has replaced some of these other connections where we sit down and really have deeper discussions about ourselves and our families and our community. And some of that, those deeper discussions have been, are gone now in lieu of what we feel is maybe adequate in terms of these connections we have across social media. And they are, you know, you could have a whole year's worth of shows about the positive and negative ramifications of it. But I think that for what we're looking at the Utah Foundation, the number of friends we have on some social media platform, or the number of likes we get, or the number of views we get on a post, we're not really counting those as kind of that social capital in terms of that which benefits individuals and groups across networks.
Now, you did mention there's negative social capital, organizations. So in the report, you give that example, you know, if you're a member of a gang or organized crime, that would not be positive. But you at the Utah Foundation, you're looking at the positive social capital.
Yeah. And looking at, it's kind of hard. There's no one measure out there that says, oh, yeah, this is what social capital is. It's this one data point, and you know, this state or this community or this neighborhood is good and doing well in that metric or in social capital, like large S, large C, and these other communities are doing poorly for whatever reason. So there's not one measure. So what we do is we touch on things like organized crime, I guess, and gangs, in terms of saying, okay, so if you have a social trust, what's the level of social trust in your community, for instance? And that's one of the metrics that we use. If you have a high level of crime in your community, you may have less social trust, And so we measure that, but then it's kind of the reverse. It's like the level of crime of maybe gang activity in our neighborhood brings down that overarching kind of social capital metric that maybe a community is experiencing.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Sean Tigan, president of the Utah Foundation. They are about to release their 2025 findings on social capital. And I want to get into, Sean, the individual areas that you measure. But before we do that, maybe just people will be wondering and want us to note this at the beginning of the program, we'll get back to it. Utah does pretty well, I think, overall.
Yeah.
In terms of social capital. Tell me about that, you had kind of the top line.
Yeah, so when we started this project about 5 or so years ago, we used a bunch of metrics, and we'll talk about those metrics a little bit more, I think, Tom, but we used a bunch of metrics that were kind of the probably at that time we figured they were the best 30 or so that we could really measure social capital. And we looked back a couple iterations into the past as well. So we looked back 4 years and then 8 years in terms of all of these metrics, these 30 or so metrics. And at the end of the day, when we released our reports in 2021, we were like, oh, Utah's at the top of the list. Utah's got the highest social capital in the nation. And it wasn't actually the case 4 years and 8 years before. We were close to the top, but we saw that like North Dakota and Minnesota, a couple other states, were doing really well as well. But the first year we released this, Utah was at the top of the list. And I'd like to talk about this more later, Tom, when we get into this. At the Utah Foundation, we feel that we shouldn't rest upon our laurels. We shouldn't feel, we're number one. We don't need to do anything about it. So there's probably still some work to be done. But it was kind of interesting to note. And then when you hear that Utah has really high social capital in different media outlets and whatnot, they're generally speaking about the Utah Foundation's work from 4 years ago.
The U.S. as a whole, how's the U.S. doing? And is there a trend?
Yeah, so we looked only at the 50 states and Washington, D.C. So we didn't look at other outside of the U.S. But when you look at the U.S. as a whole, in terms of trends, that's a very good question, Tom. If I remember right, I haven't looked at those older data, and I can't let the cat out of the bag for the newest round. But I believe that that some states were trending down a bit and pulling some of the social capital down for the nation. And if I remember right, there's a slight downward trend back to 2021 from the previous 8 years. I'm excited to share what has happened in 2025. I'll give you during this conversation a couple of tidbits as a sneak preview, but I can't give you that overarching number for 2025.
Okay. All right. One more just general question, and then we'll go to a break and come back and get into these specific factors. Yeah. I guess that general question before we go to break is, my understanding of social capital, especially social cohesion, Utah's numbers, I guess, are pretty good. And the United and many states, fairly good. But how it feels pretty bad to me, and I think a lot of us, right?
Yeah.
We look at polarization, just keeps getting worse. We look at all this conflict and just can't get along. Social cohesion, I think, or one of the factors, one of the definitions was, do you feel like your neighbor, you feel like your community as a whole makes good decisions? That feels to me like that's going downward. We don't trust our neighbors anymore. I wonder how do you square the numbers, which seem to be pretty good, including here in Utah, and I don't know how we're feeling about this.
Yeah, so one of the, if you look back in time, and we you brought up originally, Tom, Robert Putnam, and when you look back in time, I think that if we did use these metrics and went way back, 30 years ago, we might see that there are some downward trends on some of these over time. In fact, there are some downward trends in some of the data in Utah as well over time. But at the end of the day, how you feel is reality. So that we feel kind of bad about that, that the community as a whole, like that we don't have that much of a connection to the community as a whole. I think that's important. And when we talk about about Utah being number one in the state 4 years ago in terms of social capital, sure, that's great. But if we don't feel great about it, and perhaps just as importantly, if it's not even across the board in terms of, or there's not a good access to social capital, particularly for groups that may need it the most, then it seems like there's a problem. And so when I kind of mentioned that we can't rest on our laurels in terms of just this number, I think that's what I'm talking about, is that really we need to think about the community as a whole in terms of benefiting folks in terms of social capital, but also like, how do you get past the fact that social media has perhaps replaced a lot of the social interactions that people maybe 40 years ago took for granted, and 30 years ago took for granted. And now we're focusing on maybe different things that are a little bit more on the surface. And when you talk about political polarization, I was kind of joking earlier when I said there are some perhaps some good aspects to it, but I mean there are maybe in terms of like small parts of the community, but ultimately that makes a lot of people feel pretty bad and really rips apart the fabric of the nation as a whole. And you know, bringing up Robert Putnam again, he and his colleague Shailene Romney Garrett did some work on community in a book just a few years ago. And what they see is that we in the United States have shifted from a we kind of mentality to an I mentality, where there is this fracturing of people all across the United States. And it's a big deal. The implications of that, as they bring up in this book, could be perhaps kind of scary, because we haven't seen that since the Civil War, this kind of separation of people, where we, you know, there were times in the past where maybe people felt like, oh, the pandemic is going to bring everybody together. Or even way back in the early 2000s, it's like 9/11 is going to bring people together. But ultimately, maybe it did for a minute. And then the fracturing almost got worse after those potential issues could have been used as a way to really reach across the aisle and reach across religion and socioeconomic status and kind of come together as a whole across the United States.
Well, let's do take a break. We'll come back and talk about individual factors which lead into social capital, making it strong or weak. We're talking with Utah Foundation President Sean Tigan. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Utah Foundation President Sean Tigan about social capital. And the Utah Foundation released a report on social capital in Utah in 2021. They're preparing to release an update soon. And we're going to get into talking about some of the factors that lead into this. I think about seven factors. But Sean Tigan, for those who maybe have just joined us, define social capital for us again.
Yeah, so social capital are those bonds between people and among networks, which those people and networks can use to benefit themselves and the groups that they are involved in. So it's the bonds that kind of lift us up and help us out, particularly when we need a leg up on something.
Let's start with the first one. At least the first is appears in the report here. Civic engagement. How are you defining for this report civic engagement?
Yeah, so civic engagement is a fairly easy one. And I can go back to Tom and just mention real quick. So we've got these seven kind of categories of social capital, and then we've got about 30 or so metrics that go into those categories. And so for civic engagement, we look at three key measures. And one of those is voter turnout. Another one is citizen attendance of public meetings. And the last one is how many advocacy organizations do you have in your community? So it's and there's reasons why we have each of those. I think voter turnout is maybe kind of an easy one. It's and that's a pretty low bar to civic engagement. It's you know, you go and vote once a year or whatever the case may be. We don't all do it, even though it's not that perhaps that difficult to do, particularly when we've got mail-in ballots. But it's one that's a, you know, you get your I voted sticker of the old days or whatever. And it's a way you can kind of show I'm engaged in the community. And I feel part of the community enough so that I'm going to go out and vote for the candidate that I think would kind of lead the organization, this place the best.
Yeah, I was reading an op-ed piece from 2021 or 2022 when the previous report came out. I think it was Peter Reichert. He said, you know, it's important to measure other things besides voter participation because, as you just mentioned, vote by mail is it's great. You'd sit in your kitchen and there's a higher barrier if you go to your community calendar or community or your municipal council meeting.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know that's a higher barrier. You spend a lot more time doing it, and I think that depends on. I've had conversations with elected officials that are sometimes a little bit flabbergasted by the lack of variety of people that come to the public meetings. Mm-hmm. you get people that are often there because they're like, oh, we don't want the development of this high rise in our community or whatever the case may be. So they kind of use that kind of common bond of being against maybe something that some elected officials are voting on to get together and say, hey, we need to stop this because we see this as a problem for the community. Or, they may be there in support of something, but it sounds like quite often at these public meetings to get people that are more resisting a change than advocating for it. And then this one more issue, this advocacy organizations, we've actually improved, I think, this metric a little bit for the 2025 social capital series. But that's also important because when we think about the three kinds of social capital, there are these three types. And one of those is linking social capital, which is something that advocacy organizations can do to benefit social capital, to help kind of increase social capital across a community. And that's to help make those connections quite often between people of different socioeconomic groups. So it's like I am struggling financially at the house in my community. And so I'm going to go to this advocacy organization or this entity that is involved in civic engagement. And maybe they can help me out, help connect me with people that they're possibly hiring or whatever, as is the case I used before.
So how's Utah doing in civic engagement?
You know, so Utah's doing pretty well. Let's see if I remember right. Civic engagement is, let's see, we're in the top third of states in terms of civic engagement. So we're pretty good. And there was a point, Tom, where Utah, in terms of voter turnout, was doing very, very well. And people in Utah kind of, we quit voting for a while. we saw our voter turnout go way down to a low point about 10 or so years ago. And now it's recovered somewhat. So we're in the top third of states, so we're doing pretty well, but there are certainly some other areas where we're doing quite a bit better.
Next was social trust, and this was the one I think I mistakenly mentioned social cohesion for this one. I just want to read this. Social trust can be described as the extent to which people believe that others in their community will do the right thing most of the time. That's one where I just feel that feels like it's not at a very high level in terms of feelings. But how do you measure it?
Yeah. So, you know, Tom, you bring this up and it would be great to find a measure that isn't just looking at some of the bad stuff. One of the things that we're doing for this is it's basically because we also we've as Americans have had a decrease in our trust of institutions as well. And like, how do you kind of increase that and what can we do? But in terms of we mainly look at crimes for this. So are there federal corruption convictions? Are there breach of trust penalties? So these are things where like Are you doing something that's are you involved in fraud in your community, for instance, or are you a lawyer or a doctor or something and didn't work in the best interest of your clients? And then I brought up earlier, and we were talking a little bit about crime and crime in communities. What is the level of crime that we're seeing in our communities? And Utah does pretty well, at least in terms of violent crime on that metric, which is one of the reasons why we do all right in terms of this of this category of social trust.
I think I was misunderstanding this, so I guess I feel a lot better about this, and I agree. If it's do we believe our neighbors are, you know, generally not going to commit crime? Are they, you know, that sort of thing? I could see how that would be a little higher. If you define it as, do I believe my neighbor is going to vote the way I think they should, right?
Right.
Then I think a lot of us on whatever side you're on is thinking, no, I don't think my neighbor is doing the right thing. But if it's hey, they're generally going to behave themselves, well, then yes, I could see this would be fairly high. And I think Utah is fairly high on this, right?
Yeah, in fact, back 4 years ago, we were third in the nation. And again, one of the reasons is because of violent crime levels in the state. And so we feel pretty good about being out in our community and that we're not going to get robbed. There are, you know, there have been, at least in the past, and we looked into this a little bit, these kinds of, do I believe my neighbor has my best interest in mind. You know, there's been a lot of talk in Utah of, like, we are the capital of multi-level marketing and that sort of thing. And some people maybe take advantage of the social trust and the social capital in their communities to advantage themselves. And so there are some concerns around that, but even with that, we in Utah are doing pretty well on this metric, you know, third of the nation. And I can maybe hint at the fact that we're still doing pretty well in 2025.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Utah Foundation President Sean Tigan. We're talking about social capital. They're about to release their newest report on social capital. We're talking about some of the factors that lead into that. So next up is community life. And I could just guess that Utah probably does pretty well here. What are some of the things you measure on this one?
You know, we do well here, and one of the reasons why we do so well here is because of volunteerism. So we have, when you look at volunteerism in Utah compared to the other states, we are far and away at the top of the list. And you know, one of the reasons for that is it's related to church volunteerism, which, you know, if you can get somebody out and volunteering, you know, whatever, however you can do it, I think it's a great factor. And we do really well on that metric. There's also charitable donations. So we do all right in charitable donations. We attend a lot of religious services. And, you know, when I bring up religious services, I should mention that there are some overlaps between and among these categories. So community life, you might see overlap with, like, social cohesion in terms of people who attend religious services. How religious are we? It's participating in neighborhood groups. And then it's, we look at here, like we talked about advocacy organizations just a minute ago, it's other organizations, like professional organizations or non-professional organizations, like football clubs or rotary clubs and that sort of thing.
Next up is family life. I think every state would like to think they're doing well, every community, but how is Utah doing?
Yeah, you know, Utah's doing pretty well in family life too, and we've improved for 2025 some of the metrics here as well. I'm excited to say, like, we thought we did a really good job back 4 years ago, but whenever we open the can of worms again on some of these projects, we look to improve them a little bit. But back then, we were looking at things like how many of us are having meals with our family daily. How many of us are? How much TV do we watch? Especially when we're thinking about our children, and how much time do we spend on electronic devices? So we may be actually watching a little bit less TV, but we're spending a little bit more time on electronic devices than we did not too long ago. But then we also look at things like share of adults that are married, share of births to married women, and then share of children living in single parent families. So it's a whole bunch of different measures. And, you know, this is there are perhaps some of these we brought these metrics on as kind of judgment calls. And when we think about things like the share of children living in single parent families, you could have a wonderful, very tight knit family that's got great social capital, and that is, they spend a lot of time eating meals together, and there's just one parent. But the reason why we did bring up some of these metrics is like for one parent, the benefit of perhaps two parents is that then you effectively double the social capital for especially particularly small children. You've got a larger group of people that those small children can benefit in terms of social capital. And so that there's I think some of these, and I could argue with these about these the positive and negatives about each of these metrics. But I think it's nice to have, especially with this one, a number of metrics that we can bring together and to define this social capital level for family life, that is just kind of one category. But I think, eating meals together, reading together as a family, those are things that maybe have fallen by the wayside a little bit in our busy, busy lives as they become more busy over time, Tom.
So in 2021, Utah led the nation in family life. Category.
Yeah, and part of that is marriage rates, births to married women, and we also, like I said, we do well in terms of the number of multi-parent families, if however important that metric is. So we do really well. I think there are a couple of things that we don't do quite as well on, and one of the things that came up in our most recent analysis of data, or that maybe we aren't doing quite as well in terms of spending time with children as some of the other states are, and that's something that's so stay tuned for the family life report that is coming up in the next month or two.
I guess we're just getting too busy. I don't know if you have a guess on why that is.
We're getting busy, and we've talked a little bit about that one. One of the reasons I think for that is that we have more children on average in our households, and so maybe it's that those kids can spend a little bit more time playing with other kids, and so they're spending a little bit less time with their parents. Whereas if you've got fewer children in the household, then it's more of a kind of one-to-one, and that kid needs your attention quite a bit more if you've got one kid and one or two parents.
Let's take another break. We are talking with Utah Foundation President Sean Tigan. We're talking about social capital. They did a report in 2021. They have a new one about to come out, and we're talking about it on the program. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We've reached our final segment with Sean Tigan. He's the Utah Foundation president, and the Utah Foundation released a report 4 years ago about social capital. They're about to release the new one, the update, and we're talking about social capital and how Utah's doing on the program today. So, Sean Tigan, the next factor up is social cohesion. How do we define that?
Yeah, so this one has three metrics to it, and it's kind of like how similar we are as a community, and this is in terms of those three kind of categories of social capital. This is more of the bonding social capital, where we hang out with people that kind of look like us, and or have the kind of money that we have, or whatever the case may be. And so one of these is this economic stratification. So what percentage of the people are in the middle class, for instance? One of those is languages. So how many do we have groups that speak a common language? And the last is the extent to which the population is homegrown. And so we're a little bit more in the middle of the pack on this metric, particularly given that, we're a fast growing state. And while a lot of those people that are coming into the state are coming into the state internally, we're having babies, and so that increases our population pretty quickly. But we also see we have a lot of people coming from the outside, and in many ways that's great. In terms of the social capital, we think of it as then there are more there's more of a difference of groups, and that may make it a little bit harder to have kind of a natural social capital across those groups. But in terms of middle class, and I can hint a little bit at one of the metrics for 2025. When we look at middle class and the percentage of middle class in each of the states across the nation, Utah is right up at the top of the list. Like we do pretty well in terms of having a robust middle class, and so that does help with social cohesion. So even though we are only kind of in the middle of the pack on this metric, we do have a good, robust middle class here.
I notice South Dakota leads the nation in social cohesion. Montana is quite high, whereas Utah's middle of the pack. I don't know any theories about why South Dakota is so high, Montana.
Yeah, so part of that, particularly for South Dakota, is that you don't see a lot you see more of this with Montana, but you don't in South Dakota. You don't see a lot of people moving into the state. There's not a fast growing state from people coming out from out of the state into the state. So you have a population that's as maybe I mentioned, is kind of homegrown. And in addition to that, you see a population that is, you know, if you've got a common language across groups, that can help kind of benefit. Having differences in languages probably can be a little bit of a barrier to an easy kind of social capital and social networking. And so you see a little bit less of that. That barrier in South Dakota. And then in terms of middle class, you don't see, like, there's not a lot of poverty in South Dakota. Like, we don't have a whole lot in Utah either. But there are also not a lot of billionaires and millionaires in South Dakota, whereas we probably have a few more of those here in Utah, particularly from some of the people coming into the state from other places like California.
Also, I was trying to look at the list of states. California is dead last, for example. Texas, low. I don't know how racial diversity would, or diversity in general would play into this. Maybe would pull against social cohesion.
Yeah, so you know, that's a tricky time because, like, in some ways, like in a big group, you would say, oh yeah, that probably pulls against it. But also, even though California is last, you have robust communities of populations where you can have a strong social capital within these communities. So if you have a very strong Hispanic Latino community, let's say in Los Angeles County, for instance, that can benefit that population very well. Whereas if you look at it in terms of at a state level, it becomes a little bit more tricky to kind of define that. That's one of the reasons why we determined not to include race and ethnicity, but as a metric in this. But language kind of gets in there to some extent with people that are speaking perhaps English as a second language, and that is the barrier to working across networks is kind of high when people don't speak the same language.
The next factor up is focus on future generations. What are the metrics you're using here?
Yeah, so this kind of ties into one of these other metrics I talked about earlier in terms of family life, but we talk about things like birth rate. We look at investment in recreation and investment in public schools. And then the ratio of children to the number of youth organizations. So in terms of that focus on the future generation, we do have a lot of babies in Utah. And so that kind of benefits this metric. And the thought here is that you've got the downside, I guess, of that, I brought up investment in public schools. When you look at investment per capita, we have pretty low investment per capita in public schools because of the proportion of kids that we have taxpayer folks in the state. And so we have a harder time paying for education. So we actually don't use just that kind of per capita number in terms of public schools. We like to look at how much of our money per $1,000 in personal income do we use on schools? And that number is not quite as bad, but it has also been decreasing in Utah since the late 1990s. So we've seen a kind of a decrease on that metric over time. We've also seen a decrease in the birth rate. One positive thing, though, is that we do have a pretty robust investment in recreation. And you see that this kind of ebbs and flows depending on how much, what the economy looks like and how much extra tax revenue communities have. But if you look around, you'll see that particularly in growing communities, we see more and more parks all the time. And it's not just park spaces, but it's, pickleball courts and the other kinds of activities that get people to parks, like splash pads and those sorts of things.
I notice on this one, focus on future generations. North Dakota and Nevada lead the nation. Utah's was number five, so it's Utah's doing fairly well.
Yeah, Utah's doing fairly well, and if we were a little bit farther up there in that metric of amount spent per $1,000 of personal income on education, we'd be doing even a little bit better. But unfortunately, that like I said, that's been slipping in it, and it's continued to slip actually since 2021.
You know, in the report, Utah's birth rate's been in precipitous decline. That was the 2021 report. I don't think much has changed in the intervening 4 years. How does that affect this particular metric?
Yeah, so I guess that we in Utah, if we would have looked at Utah, 20 years ago, we were very different, or 30 or 40 years ago, we were very different in terms of birth rate compared to the rest of the nation. But we're looking a little bit more like the rest of the nation now, Tom, in terms of birth rate. And part of that is because of the growth of this community that we see. People know that this is a pretty great place, and they come here from other states. And so we see a birth rate that's starting to mirror the rest of the nation, because we are starting to look a little bit more like the rest of the nation than we did 30 or 40 years ago.
The last factor is social mobility. How do you define that?
Yeah, so one of these, it's things like, what are the things that can bring you out of a certain socioeconomic state into the next one? And one of those is public, it's post-secondary education. So it's education after high school. And those might be, high quality certificates, or they might be bachelor's degrees or whatever. And so that's a really important one. Another one is home ownership levels. And there are some benefits to home ownership in terms of community. You're like building a community by being in a place and knowing your neighbors maybe longer than if you're in an apartment, kind of moving in and out of apartments. It's also economic mobility in terms of like, how much did your parents earn and how much do you earn? There used to be, it used to be pretty likely that you would earn more than your parents did by the time you were their age. And now that's becoming less and less likely every year, unfortunately. And then the last one is disengaged youth. So what proportion of us are young, maybe, 17 to 24, but we're not in school, we don't have a job more than maybe, mowing the lawn in the backyard or whatever, and we don't have a lot of prospects. And so those are the metrics we use for this social mobility metric.
So briefly, housing would really affect this, and these days kind of in a negative way, right?
Yeah, housing is going to affect this one. And, something that we see, Utah has always been doing pretty well in terms of our homeownership levels. Like if you look at Utah compared to the rest of the nation in homeownership, we were always like, 5 percentage points or more above the rest of the nation. But now that housing has our costs have really skyrocketed. I mean, they've skyrocketed around the nation, but we are now catching up to some communities in California, and we're catching up to some communities. And like Denver used to be so expensive, and now it's like, we're the same as them in many ways. And we're going to see, I think, a decrease in home ownership as we move along because of those costs. And so, you know, Tom, you brought this up at the top of the show, like this, when you look around, I don't feel that great about some of the social capital in the community. And it says some of these things like home ownership, we're going to have to work to increase other types of social capital in the face of things like a decrease in home ownership for future generations.
So in general, Utah is doing quite well, at least in comparatively. But as you mentioned earlier, and maybe this would be a good way to end the program, we just have about a minute or two left. What do we need to keep an eye on? What do we need to work on?
Yeah, so, you know, so broadly, Tom, I think that we have places, even when we're, even back in 2021, when we had the top social capital in the nation, I think that they're broadly, it's yeah, that's great. If you yourself have social capital, that's strong. But I think that there are lots of populations that don't have really robust social capital. And so I think that one of the things that we need to do is as people that maybe don't have a lot of social capital, but as others as well, is to recognize that there are organizations out there that we can get involved in that are doing really good work around helping people with social capital. And I can give a couple examples if you like, but I think that that's one of those things is helping spread it to other folks. But it's also, you know, we are in our own homes and in our own families, we can help benefit the social capital. We can help raise the social capital of our families. And particularly, we just talked about disengaged youth a little bit ago. What can we do in our own homes to make sure that there aren't those disengaged people out there, that we can get them out in the community? Maybe start off with volunteering and getting them out to different social activities in order to help increase the social capital for generations to come. But overall, I think that a couple of the like specifics are focusing on future generations, and part of that is making sure that we are giving not just the disengaged youth that might be in our own homes, but that youth across the board opportunities to participate in youth organizations and youth activities, and making sure that they're educated well enough so that they have the opportunities, if they'd like to pursue some of those social, those post-secondary opportunities, if they'd like to make sure that they're getting the certificates and certifications and degrees that are going to benefit them and their own household economics, but also the economics of the state as a whole.
All right. And you can check out the 2021 report, I think, by going to utahfoundation.org, right? And the new one, that's where we'll see the new one, I guess.
That's where you'll see the new one. Well, we've actually, this project is coming out in nine different reports, and we'll be talking about the three kinds of social capital: the bonding, bridging, and linking social capital. And really, one of the things we're doing with this series of reports is talking about ways that we can improve social capital in the state. And that's something we didn't do as much 4 years ago.
All right, we've been talking with Utah Foundation President Sean Tighe, and Sean, thank you so much.
Hey Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
It's the Beehive Archive on Utah Public Radio. I'm Megan Weiss. In 1928, a women's club in Moab adopted official song that crowed, "In this little town of ours, we have a literary club, and we derive from it everything good. It helps the town and public in numerous ways." Learn more about these women and their service after this.
I'm Jody Graham, Director of Utah Humanities. Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by Utah Humanities, with the generous support of the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation. We are proud to partner with community organizations to tell Utah stories and hope you will tune in each week for the Beehive Archive.
Women's clubs had a profound impact on Utah's rural communities throughout the 20th century. Nationally popular, such clubs connected women through volunteer work, scholarship, and advocacy. The Women's Literary Club in the southern Utah town of Moab boasted several accomplishments aimed at bettering the community. Members were interested in civic projects, such as improving public sanitation, establishing libraries and museums, as well as encouraging volunteer work. These Moab women leveraged their time and relationships to make a lasting impact on their growing town. Founded in 1897 as the Busy Women's Club, the group initially focused on learning. Early meetings hosted guest speakers who lectured on foreign nations and human rights. However, when the group renamed itself to the Women's Literary Club in 1914, it marked a new focus on civic improvement and literacy. Members saw their participation as necessary for the health of their small rural town. One of the club's most impressive achievements was their work to establish the public library. Starting in 1915, they brought in roughly 2,500 books and raised over $300 in the span of 30 minutes to purchase a plot of land for the library. The club grew quickly, with no cap on membership, and attendance rose to 48 members in 1927. But their work was not always easy. Despite some initial success, funding was difficult to come by due to Moab's small population and growing concerns over World War I. Nonetheless, the women forged ahead. They opened up a small club-run community library in the courthouse, and when the building was demolished in 1934, they moved the library to the high school. After that location burned down in 1967, they fought for and received federal and county funding to build on the lot they had purchased back in 1915. The Women's Literary Club had a profound effect on the development of Moab. In addition to building the library, they worked to establish a fine arts guild, senior center, the Moab Museum, and raised money for countless other organizations through community events. Their work used volunteer labor and education to make meaningful change in this corner of Utah. Find sources in past episodes of the Beehive Archive at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of Utah Humanities, I'm Megan Weiss.